Welcome to Paris, Professor Patterson, and welcome to everybody. And thank you for having accepted our invitation. This program, Diverse Experiences and Common Causes, is based on a question. The question is, it's a cultural, anthropological, sociological, and political question. How to imagine and conceptualize a possible way of living together, not in spite of our differences, but because of them and enriched by them. And with Montia, we think that the answer to this question is more urgent than ever. In our times when societies are fragmenting and inequalities are worsening, and this is true in the States, as in France or in other countries in Europe. So in such a perspective, it's necessary to have a deep and concrete knowledge of our societies, and especially of the historical roots of cultural, social, and racial disparities. As a sociologist, you have done very important survey studies which reveal the complexity of ethno-racial relations in American society. And you have underlined the paradox of a situation, especially under Obama presidency. Of course, after Donald Trump election, we wonder how the situation can evolve, and we are going to listen to you on that point and on the paradox of race in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction and for inviting me here to Paris, a city which I used to visit in my silent days as a graduate student in the London School of Economics, but come here all too infrequently. So I'm happy to be here, happy to discuss with you issues which you and your own country are beginning to grapple with now. I had a prepared text, but in view of the size of the audience, and I think perhaps I'm more interesting when I speak spontaneously rather than from a text, so I'm going to discard the text and just talk to you about the basic issues, but I'll be using my PowerPoint nonetheless. So I want to explain to discuss what I call the paradoxes of race in America. Two of them I highlight. There are many paradoxes, but I want to highlight two. What I call the private-public paradox of the Black American condition. I'll explain in a moment what I mean by that. The other is a more recent one, but it's a continuation of the first, as we'll see. It's what I call the Obama-Trump paradox. Having discussed them, having presented them, I want to offer an explanation of them in terms of the three Americas, what I call three Americas. Now, there are many Americas. It's a vast continent with many geographic zones and cultural zones, but I want to focus on three, which I think are most relevant to the issue of race and diversity and multiculturalism. What I call Herrenvolk, America, Middle America, and Multicultural America. I think these together explain not only the condition of African Americans, the rise of Obama, but also the paradox of the Trump victory coming so soon after. My explanation is socio-historical, as are all my explanations. There are no good explanation which doesn't take account of history, especially historical sociologists, and I say this as a historical sociologist. The one who emphasizes the long durée, it's in the tradition of the founder of the Maison, the Science, and Fernand Braudel, who is one of my heroes, and maybe known here more as a historian, but in America is celebrated among historical sociologists. In fact, there's an institute of historical sociology studies named after Braudel at New York, one of the New York universities. So that then is what I'm going to try to do today. First of all, the public, private-public paradox of Black Americans. What I mean here is something that has emerged in America, which may puzzle some of you here in this part of the side of the Atlantic. On the one hand, the near complete acceptance of African American in the public life of America, in the public sphere of America. There's nothing like this anywhere else in the world. There's nothing like this in any of the white majority societies, including this one, as I'll try to get to in a minute. But extraordinary success in the integration of Black Americans in the public sphere. But this goes along with persisting, striking segregation in the private sphere. Again, there's nothing like this anywhere else. And it's unusual to find such a situation, and it may well puzzle some of you. It should. This persisting exclusion almost, or separation at the private level. In many ways, Obama embodies this paradox, because we have there, in fact, the fact that a Black man was held and continues for the next few days to hold the most powerful position in the world, head of the American political system. Yet, in a situation in which Black Americans are still socially if not dire, sort of serious problems in the integration in America. By the Obama-Trump paradox, this is a continuation, in a way, of this first broader paradox. And this is a simple question, which again, I hope it's puzzled some of you. Why is it that at the end of this historic Black presidency, can imagine sort of, well, 8 years ago, the last time I came to Paris, was just a little after Obama was elected, and I remember the celebratory mood, the mood of triumphalism. Black America seemed to have triumphed over its racial problems, and there's even talk of a post-racial America, which was all this nonsense, but that's how far the triumphalism went. Nonetheless, it was an extraordinary development. Yet after, and he wasn't just elected once, this wasn't a fluke. He was elected twice. Yet, after twice electing a Black president, we should have America electing a misogynistic, Islamophobic, anti-immigrant president who was appointed a white supremacist as his chief domestic advisor. And it's not just that, too, because this comes in the wake of real pessimism about race in America, even before Trump was elected. In a way, Trump's election is, in a way, just a reflection and culmination of very deep, deep concern about race, pessimism coming out of the Black, reflected in the Black Lives Matter movement, reflected in the large number, almost growing number of killings of black youth and the strong reaction in the movement, Black Lives Matter movement, but also a general feeling that things had gone off the rails as far as race, or that we were in fact almost going backwards. As these two, as this slide indicates, the left panel, many blacks are skeptical that the country will eventually make changes necessary for racial equality. It's not extraordinary. As you can see, there are a significant number of black Americans feel that we'll never make any racial progress. Our country will not make the changes needed to guide blacks, to give blacks equal rights with whites. 43% of black people think that. In the waning days of a black presidency. The right panel of this slide gives you the very starkly different views of where the racial situation is in the United States. Differences between blacks and whites about equality. That 61% of white folks think that blacks have already achieved racial equality, compared with 17.4% of blacks. The two groups are very far apart. That's where we're at. How come? How is this possible? Such enormous differences in perception of where race is, race relations, of even what's achievable, and such remarkable differences between the major groups. How do we explain this? There is even the view, not only that Obama did not make things better, but indeed a third of all white Americans say that Obama's made race relations worse. This is a rather extraordinary situation, wouldn't you say? What I want to talk about then is to flesh out these paradoxes, beginning with the first one, of what was achieved and what was not achieved in explaining the fact that black Americans have this extraordinary bifurcation in their achievements. So, what was achieved by the civil rights movement? Political inclusion. Blacks became a defining element of the American body politic in both politics and culture. And as I said earlier, there are 15% of the population. That's in fact, generous estimate. It's more like 14%, but are a major player in the political life of the nation. This graph shows, the Democratic Party, in fact, the two major parties, is strongly dependent on its black American base. It's the most faithful and the most vigorous base of the party. And in fact, as you can see, as support for Democrats has declined overall in the nation, the increased support percentage of blacks who support their dependence on the black support has increased. But that achievement also goes in other areas of public life. In the extraordinary role of blacks in the nation's military, they're highly represented, not only in the lower ranks, but in the officer ranks. And indeed, one of their numbers, Colin Powell, achieved the highest position in the military as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The military is the repository of a nation's, not just their defense, but a nation's honor. And the role of blacks in that area cannot be exaggerated. In fact, the military is more integrated than the civilian part of the United States. As one military sociologist, Muscus, pointed out, it's the only one of the few areas of American life where blacks routinely boss about whites. Important to note, too, in comparison with other countries, with black minorities, whether it's France or England, or, which is, I guess, understandable, but more importantly, in Latin America, where blacks constitute significant proportions of the population, where you find very few members of the military elite, many of them lily white. One of the saddest things for me about the Cuban Revolution, and I was a student right next door, Jamaica's only 90 miles away, when the Cuban Revolution took place, is one of the great events of my life. And of course, one of the great promises of the revolution was to transform the status of blacks in that country. And a lot was achieved in that regard. But there's one interesting thing about the Cuban Revolution. If you look at the Cuban Politburo, it's lily white. Reflects something interesting about Latin America, which I'll get to in a minute. There's also the rise of a significant black upper class and elite. Again, this is something worth noting, that blacks have, it's not just in the middle class, they've penetrated the elite. In many ways, the elite is more integrated than many other areas of American life. So it's surprising the number of major companies which are headed by blacks. That's Kenneth Chenault comes, I like to mention, is the CEO of American Express with an annual income of $81 million. That's almost more than what all black low class people have. Well, that's an exaggeration. But there is this woman who is head of Xerox, the head of Time Warner, and so on. I can list any number of them. Now, this integration too is found, is startlingly so, in a cultural, social, public cultural life of America. So blacks have an outsized influence on its music. Jazz is the civilizational voice of America. Well, it's not only jazz, it's hip-hop, in a sense, dominates popular culture. But in sports, of course, the black presence is almost overwhelming. In dance, in TV, in the arts, sort of fully complete integration, almost dominance. I mean, look, that, what have I done? Let's make sure I get this. This picture is a group of almost all white Americans in a show of absolute devotion to the queen mother of American popular culture. Where is she? Oprah Winfrey. That's her there. Her status in American popular culture is hard to define. My favorite way of describing it is that a poll was once taken, and people were asked, who is the person most likely to go to heaven when they died? And she came in next, very close second to Mother Teresa. So,
her devoted followers are
overwhelmingly white. We're not talking about, we're talking Trump country, and so on. So, that is. Of course, you know these figures very well, I take it. Jay-Z, Beyonce, and in sport. I mean, it's hard to exaggerate the influence of sports, but I'll give you an example. And LeBron James is the influence. When the Cleveland basketball team, after a long drought, won the national sporting event in basketball. It was an occasion of the most incredible celebration. It brought the whole city together. Over 2 million people turned up for the event, for a city about the size of 500,000. I mean, so they're coming in from the suburbs and so on, in expressions of total veneration for a team that was almost completely black. And I gave a talk in Cleveland just a couple months ago, in which when I mentioned the team, people immediately sort of cheered. but then I pointed out the odd thing is that how many people who had gone in this celebration on going back to their suburban homes would see someone looking like LeBron or any of the heroes moving in could resist the temptation to call their real estate agent to think of moving out. So this illustrates the paradox more than anything else. So what you have in America is an interesting phenomenon, which when compared with Latin America, it's largely a top-down integration. Done very well in the rise of the middle class and even integration in the elite, leading to the most powerful position. But the lower down you go in America, the more segregated it becomes. So that among the poorest, whites and so on, is the greatest separation to Appalachia or anywhere else. It's the direct opposite in Latin America, where you know, if you go to Cuba and you go to the poorer parts of Cuba, you go to Brazil and you go to the favelas of Brazil, they are living cheek by jowl, very close, total integration. In Brazil, whites attend, low-class whites are devotees of the African American, sort of Afro-Brazilian church, Candomblé, and so on. In Cuba, too. When I visit Santeria ceremonies in Cuba, at least a third, sometimes a half of the audience are whites. So at the low class level, the higher up you go, the lighter and lighter it gets until you get to the top and there's nobody. There's hardly a black face. And if you look at the embassies, so take a look at the Brazilian embassy in France. I don't know whatever, I can guess that they're a little white. Brazil is 50, at the last census, 50% of Brazilians claim to be of part African ancestry. It reminds me of a joke about George Bush. There are many jokes about him, but this one is true. When Cardoso, the president of Brazil, visited the White House, and they were chatting away, and Cardoso mentioned to Bush that, we have adopted your affirmative action program here. We are a model for race, what you should do about race. And Bush turned to Cardoso in great surprise and said, "You've got them there too." He didn't know that there are blacks in Brazil. But I defend Bush on these grounds, because when Bush looks around at the embassy, the Brazilian embassy, what he sees is white faces. When he meets any member of the elite, whether it's from the military or what he sees is the white country. It's hard to believe that the largest black population out of Africa is in Brazil. So very opposite. This is America has this very odd sort of situation of a top-down integration. The election of a black president in Brazil is unimaginable right now, even though it's 50%. Black ancestry. The same is true in Cuba or in any other countries. Okay, so that's America. That's a great public integration of the society, which needs to be acknowledged, celebrated. And accompanying this on the broadest level has been changing racial attitudes. In the broadest level, and see the significance of this in a minute. Any measure you want to use, and we usually tend to use the surveys by the gold standard of surveys in America, which is the Chicago's GSS, General Social Survey, which indicates a clear pattern of growing liberal attitudes on race. In whatever index you want to use, perhaps the most sort of sensitive one, people who say blacks are more intelligent or unintelligent than whites. And as you can see, this has been substantially declining to well below 20%. That's what they say. And interestingly, when you compare white Republicans and black and white Democrats, there isn't much difference. As a matter of fact, just a slight tilt. Recently, and one thing I should mention on this changing overall racial attitudes is, of course, there's an important age difference, as the right panel indicates here, that the younger population in America are very, very liberal in their racial attitudes. And this is true not only in surveys, but this is observable. This is one of the more sensitive indices, you know, support for international marriages. And as you can see, it changes rather dramatically with age. Over 65, only a little over a third of white support that. I mean, this means it reflects some racist attitudes, if you like. Whereas it's 88% of young whites. And that's really striking. And a major change in America. If you ever lose heart about American race relations, I say just observe the young, not only in their attitudes, but in their behavior. Okay? So this is the overall development. Extraordinary integration in the public life and changing attitudes in the broad sense. Okay. Well, there's a lot that the civil rights movement did not achieve. And to understand race in America, you have to understand its failures. It did not close the income gap. It did not as you can see from these graphs, racial gaps in household income persist. Indeed, the writer and panel is a little depressing. In 1967, the median income of black households was 60.5% of white households. In 2013, it is exactly 64.5%. Not much progress there, right? In terms of, in absolute terms, the income has gone up, which explains the rise of the middle class. But the, as you can see, in these two graphs, the gap remains almost. In fact, it's widened a bit from this one. But the other thing to note, which is even more startling, is something not often mentioned, is the wealth gap. This is more important than the income gap in many ways, the amount of wealth you own, right? Equity in your home, stuff like that. It's really quite extraordinary. The average white household has about $141,000. The average black household is $11,000. The white net worth is 13 times greater than the black net worth. So it's not much progress. In fact, it's gotten worse on that score. The poverty gap has declined, as you can see in this graph, quite substantially. But it began to increase again in recent years, although it went down a bit under Obama. But as you can see, a huge difference between the poverty rate of blacks, which is 24, almost a quarter of the population, compared with the white poverty rate. And not much has moved with the black lower class, either in absolute or relative terms. Now another discouraging development, though, in recent years, which sociologists have been paying increasing attention to, is that this celebrated growth of the black middle class seemed to have stalled. And indeed, black American middle class is, in fact, declining. It's not reproducing itself. A remarkable proportion of the black middle class youth are declining into the black lower classes. Half of black Americans are born poor and stay poor. And most black middle class kids are downwardly mobile. Nearly half are in fact not only not achieving their parents' status, but are declining. And when they decline to the bottom. So that's depressing news. And then there's the segregation, the problem of segregation. For me, that's one of the major factors. As I mentioned earlier, the paradox is that African Americans are as segregated now, almost as segregated now, as they were during the civil rights, just before the civil rights movement. Remember, one of the major goals of the civil rights movement was integration. And this graph, this index essentially indicates the proportion of the population, black population, which would have to move in order to achieve racial parity in neighborhoods. It's used as a version of the Gini coefficient. As you can see, it's bad news if you believe in integration. Metropolitan blacks in the city areas is 6-4. So what simply we have to, if it's fully integrated, it's zero. If it's fully segregated, it's 100%. Just think of that. So 3/4 of blacks in the non-metro areas have to move for there to be any kind of semblance of integration. It's a little less in the metropolitan areas, but not a great deal less. Now one of the ironies of this is that the situation is no better. Indeed, many of the worst areas in terms of segregation are among the most liberal parts of America, including, and many of you are from New York, Chicago, the hometown of our president, Detroit. These are all, Quant, one of your French-turned American sociologists would call hyper-segregated society. Isn't that strange? This may seem odd, what happened to the growth of the black middle class. Well, the interesting thing about the black middle class is that for all their growth, for all their extraordinary role in black public life, they are almost as segregated as the black lower class. Middle class America, black America, and the sort of go-to volume on that is Mary Petula's work, Black Picket Fences. And she just looks at a black middle class community outside Chicago, almost completely segregated. And that's through Baltimore and so on. It has no relation to income. In Maryland, for example, which has the wealthiest, Prince George's County is maybe one of the wealthiest black middle class communities, fully segregated. Atlanta, which has the largest number of black millionaires in the country, totally segregated. That the situation in general, it's even more the case among black youth. Last year I produced a book, I edited a volume, which is fairly well received, except by the New Yorker, which actually did do me the compliment of publishing, of reviewing it. They never review sociology books. I sort of was thankful for small mercies. But on black youth, and you know, the paradox is greatest there. You know, sort of their influence, sports, and of course music and culture is extraordinary, but horrendous social conditions, high unemployment rates, catastrophic rates of incarceration, and you know, the 1 in 3 of all black youth who they're not complete high school will have gone to prison at some time, and 1 in 5 of all young blacks will have gone to spend some time in jail. America has this obscenely high rate of incarceration, the highest in the history of the world. And black Americans, youth only, 15% constitute nearly a half of that. One of my disappointments with Obama is that he waited too long to try to do something about that. And he's trying in his last days, but it's too late. And we now have, of course, a president-elect, one of whose platform was to go back to a law and order and massive rates of imprisonment, which will, in fact, reverse whatever good Obama did. So, there you have it. Strange situation. Remarkable top-down integration, remarkable presence in the public life of the nation, in the culture of the nation. I like the word America is indelibly blackish in its culture. And that's been going on for a long time, by the way. One of the unusual things about America, compared with, say, France or anywhere else, is the degree to which the culture, even during from as early as the period of slavery, absorbed and incorporated black cultural life. And it did so even while, of course, excluding blacks. So one of the interesting things to note is that the black cultural presence didn't begin with hip hop or rock and roll. In fact, students of culture have increasingly discovered something extraordinary about the 19th century. The equivalent of the cinema, popular entertainment in the 19th century, was the minstrel show. That's where the masses went. Instead of watching television, which didn't exist, they went to minstrel shows. And what were minstrel shows? Minstrel shows were essentially people acting in blackface, performing black culture. Now, for a long time, because of the caricatured nature of the characters, people didn't really probe deeply into this, what was going on. But a remarkable group of young cultural studies students have discovered something extraordinary that they should have known for a long time. That, in fact, what they were doing was presenting black culture straight, unadulterated. But they had to deny, in denying the creators from whom they appropriated the culture by mocking them with blackface. That's what blackface is about. They weren't mocking the culture, they were mocking the cultural creators. Several remarkable recent texts on this. My favorite is Lott's book, John Lott's book, Love and Theft. But it's, so this extraordinary incorporation has been going on for so long in America. So how do we explain what's going on? So, in a way, I've been discussing America in broad terms, especially when you look at racial changes and so on. But this is a continent with many different parts, many different regions, many different kinds of society. And I want for us to look at it in a, take a closer look at America. And I'd like to emphasize the fact that there are three Americas as far as race goes. What I call Herrenhoch America, Middle America, and Multicultural America. It's where we are right now. And I think you'll get a better understanding of race in America if you understand what I'm about to tell you. Looking more closely at this great country. Herrenhoch America. I spent a lot of time studying it. As some of you may know, I'm primarily a student of slavery. This is the part of America with which, remember when we saw those overall figures, we noticed a quite striking and admirable trend down in racist attitudes decline. But we noticed that it leveled off somewhere about 25%. This is still hardcore 20%. Well, it depends on how you look at the glass. You could say, you know, yeah, but that means 75% of whites have sort of changed attitudes. That's true, but there are two things to note. 25% of 400 million people is still a lot of people. And when you realize that blacks are only 14% or so, it does mean that for every black person, there are at least two hardcore racists that remain. And they're likely to be the whites whom they encounter as policemen and so on. But that, let's look at this. This group is found mainly in the former Confederate South, though not all Southerners, let me say, belong to this Herrenhoch group, which I'll explain more in a minute. It's the German word, of course, means sort of racially superior group, democratic in a democracy. And it's not confined to the South. It's from right up the Appalachian Belt. You'll find it in parts of Southern Illinois, Indiana, and so on. But it's primarily in the old parts of the old Confederacy. The view of race here is a zero-sum view of race. White identity is central to people's definition of themselves. And it's zero-sum in the sense that, and this is a critical part of the Herrenhoch principle, what's good for blacks is seen as inherently bad for whites. Any improvement in the black condition is by definition a loss of status on the part of whites. It's a deep belief in this. Whiteness becomes an important part of people's identity, defining themselves. As important a category as age and gender. To be white is very, very significant. It's a social good. It's an asset which you cherish. As opposed to something which you just take for granted, or, you know, in a predominantly white society, whiteness has relatively little social, it's a social good, it's a descriptor. But if everybody is white, then being white doesn't mean much. Same thing in the middle of Africa, the Congo, being black doesn't mean very much in terms of defining one's identity. This is contradistinctive. Whiteness is defined in terms of blackness. But there's also increasingly being defined in positive terms as European civilization. That's the alt conservative group you've been hearing about, right? That's Mr. Bannon and the Breitbart group. Whiteness as not only what is traditionally the case in this area, very strong, contradistinctively defined, those who are not black, but also, and therefore keeping blacks down is an important part of elevating white status, but increasingly now sort of Euro-American white civilization, the carriers of white civilization. The group that met to celebrate Trump's, the alt-right group that met to celebrate Trump's victory a week or so after he won, was giving the Hitler salute and hail Trump, and sort of talking about the group, whites as a conquering group, and white civilization being under threat, and so on. That's the sort of revival of this. You'll find demographically that this kind of attitude is greatest where the black population is at its highest, the proportion of blacks. There have been several interesting studies on this, which I don't have the time to get into, which shows a clear relationship. Not just the presence of black, but sort of where blacks are in highest proportion, which tends to be in this old Confederacy, okay? And the persistence of the view that blacks do not belong. One of the fundamental features of slavery was what I call natal alienation, the fact that the slave does not belong by definition. Now, when slavery was abolished in America, it was not the slaves, only one aspect of slavery was removed. But slavery plays a really remarkable role, not only in this culture, and explains a lot about broader developments. Now, one of the interesting many paradoxes of America, of course, was that its revolution were led by slaveholders. I mean, you know, Washington, Jefferson, the lot. There are a few exceptions, but a lot of compromises had to be made in order to bring the South into the Union, one of which was you had to accept slavery. One directly explains the recent absurdity in American politics, that Hillary Clinton won 2.7 million more votes than Trump, yet Trump won. And Trump won because of these strange things called the Electoral College. And how did America end up with this weird thing? It goes right back to slavery. It goes to the South in its negotiation to join the Union, insisting on certain terms. One of them, of course, is the fact that if they only counted the white population, they would not be well represented, but outnumbered by the North. So one of the things they negotiated was that we should count the blacks. But you can't count the blacks since slaves by definition were not citizens. So they came up with this absurd decision that blacks would be counted as, you know, sort of two-thirds of a white person. So that increased their numbers, and therefore their number of representation. They also, of course, were terrified of the majority. In that respect, they had many people who supported them in the North, and indeed came up with this cockeyed idea of the Electoral College, which was directly related to the Southern negotiation, the terms on which they join. So by counting the number of slaves as part people, it increased their number of representation, even though the number of voters, of course, is restricted to the white population. When slavery was abolished, so only the legal dimension of slavery was removed, not the culture of slavery. More particularly, the fact that blacks would never belong. And of course, Jim Crow and all that went with it was just a neo-slavery system. Think of Jim Crow as neo-slavery. Every aspect of slave culture persisted, indeed was intensified, because blacks were seen as an even greater threat. Under slavery, blacks were under control of particular masses. Now they're supposed to be free. Therefore, the white population had to act collectively to ensure that they were kept down and excluded. So a neo-slavery system persisted right until the civil rights movement, which was in a way a second abolition movement. It's the best way of thinking of American. And one interesting studies indicate then what is the influence of the slave past on modern politics. We just saw one I just gave you, the fact that the Electoral College this itself came out of that. The recent interesting study, there are two recent interesting studies, I wish I had the time to go through with you, using modern techniques, statistical techniques, as well as the use of masked data, big data. This is one of them. This one uses the use of the N-word, nigger, in internet searches. And you can see this is the far greater than average. This is the old Confederacy there. This is striking here, for example. Hillary's, the tragedy of those of us who are watching the returns on election night, of course, when we're supposed to have had a big surge of Hispanic votes on behalf of Hillary, which did take place down here in Florida. But then the votes started coming from there, from the panhandle, and that's when she got wiped out, this whole region, okay? Now you can see it goes all the way up here. And the data is rough, but it gives you a very interesting non-survey type response to what where the hardcore of racists lie, to the degree that you accept that index. And it's been shown to be a fairly good one. The other is a recent study by several political scientists, which just looked at essentially what they found is that there are differences in the South. Democrats, there are different Democrats in the South. I mean, over 40% of Texas voted Democratic and so on. What they did is a more fine-grained look at where the Cotton Belt was. What are the counties which were most involved with cotton, which have been the ones most involved with slavery, as opposed to those that were not involved with cotton. In the South, and what they found is that the best predictor, one of the best predictor of the Republican vote today is the proportion of the population in the Cotton Belt of America. Certainly a better predictor than the survey is the polls. it's quite a remarkable study. The whites who currently live in southern counties that high shares of slaves in 1860 are more likely to identify as Republicans, oppose affirmative action, and express racial resentment and colder feeling towards blacks. And if all of these, they did, it's a fairly sophisticated statistical analysis because they did controls and they looked at the other kinds of explanations, such as the proportion of population black and so on. They cannot be explained by existing theories, including the theory of contemporary racial threats. The racial threat theory is what I mentioned earlier. The higher the proportion of blacks, the greater the tendency to vote right wing. So it's not, slavery is still very much there, right? Here in Voch, America, they're still with us. Oops. Huh. Seem to have missed out on something here. I'm not quite sure where my, I seem to have moved. Okay. Middle American race relations, the second major group. Now, and this is important to remember if you're trying to understand Trump's victory as not entirely a racial one, okay? I'm referring here to that whole swath of America, the Midwest, but it also spreads out. Again, it's not purely geographical. This is a more racial attitudes. but it's the heart of it is the Midwest. And substantial decline in overt racism, measured in 21. Now, people are sophisticated enough, you could say, to say they're not racist, but also you'll find in the there is, however, a persistence of clear covert racism, racial bias. And the audit studies show this. Let me just go ahead and show you one of the things done by my colleague, Deva Peja. She, instead of doing surveys, what she did was look at audit studies. So audit studies, you send around, say, request for, you want to get a rent a house, and you send around the person's qualifications are to whites and blacks are exactly the same in terms of income and so on. And but one indication of the person's race, either by their name or what have you. And it shows clear persisting bias. This one was done by Deva in Milwaukee. And this is the effect of a prison, having a prison record. Here what she did was to, people were sending interviews, whites and blacks with exactly similar qualification, one of which had a prison record and one of which didn't. Now the primary finding of the study is that having a prison record was, of course, devastating in terms of getting a job, and this is going to be one of the consequences of America's mass imprisonment. When people leave the prisons, they can't get jobs. Now that comes out clear. That's true for both black and white, okay? But there's a secondary finding here. So as you can see, for blacks, being having a prison record is you only get called by 5% of the time, as opposed to 14%. For whites, also having a prison record matters. You get called back 17% of the time, as opposed to 37% of the time. Well, so having a prison record matters for both whites and blacks in terms of getting a job. But the other finding of this study is just as startling, that in fact, a black person with a prison record, without a prison record, is less likely to be called back than a white person with a prison record. Now that's middle America. This is Milwaukee, right? So racism is still there. Well, it's more covert, and you just got to dig it out in audit studies and things like that. But it's still different from overt sort of Herrenvog racism. Blacks are accepted in the public and economic sphere. So as I mentioned, Cleveland is just crazy about their black teams and so on, and they love their black sportsmen, and they accept the fact that Cleveland is a black culture in many ways, in public life and so on. But segregation persists. So this is where the paradox of public acceptance, private separation exists. And there's racial tension tend to arise with economic insecurity. Now, my colleague Larry Bobo refers to this as laissez-faire racism, what he calls a kinder, gentler anti-black ideology. Maybe a little strong, but what he's getting at here is that things are okay when the economy is fine. They don't mind working with blacks as they do in the Herrenvog system. I've been very close to those niggas and so on, right? So it's fine. And during the golden years, post-war economic years, this is when you got things really swimming. This is when the factories in Detroit, you see all black and white workers. They didn't mind. They think everybody is earning a good income. So, bring the blacks in. We're fine working with them. But as things get bad, it gets reflected in growing tensions. So you get, that's the situation there. Now remember this group. God, this is your Midwestern, this is your Rust Belt group, okay? This is Milwaukee, and which broke Wisconsin, which broke the heart of Hillary, and so on, right? And trying to figure out that's where the major shift took place. And then there's multicultural America. This is America, mainly of the west, east, of the coast, maybe the majority, not the majority, but the largest group in many ways. And America defined in terms of multiculturalism and its diversity. You've heard about that, right? And in principle, that's how America is now seen, and that is the vision of America, the liberal vision of America. It's not just a vision, it's real. California is very multicultural, multi-ethnic society. Increased almost majority minorities now. New York, the whole of the East Coast, my state, all the way down. Florida in the southern section, not in the panhandle, so you can't sort of define the entire state like that. But the two East Coasts, so the multicultural principle prevails. And it's the dominant idea in the Republican Party. It dominates liberal ideology, okay? Now, but there is a division here. I distinguish between two basic kinds of multiculturalism. Now, I gather you've had Taylor talking about multiculturalism and several others. But I distinguish between pluralistic and what I call assimilative multiculturalism. Pluralistic multiculturalism basically rejects any idea for mainstream culture. It's hostile to that idea, in fact. It's considered, it's often defined as Anglo-conformity, bourgeois cultures, bourgeois white culture, and so on. It's rejected. Ethnicity is seen as the primary basis of one's identity. Okay, now there's an interesting parallel with the Aryan box system, but it's one of the primary definers of one's identity, along with class and what have you, and so on. But you're proud of being Latino, proud of being Irish. Everybody has their annual day in which they go out and march, and expect everybody else to come and cheer them along, and so on. You know, the Irish, the Puerto Ricans, the West Indians. Lots of meeting in the public sphere. In the political public sphere, lots of collaboration between blacks and Latinas and what have you. And the public culture. The embodiment of this is the musical Hamilton. Okay, and it's no accident that they got up and told off Pence when he turned up, right? So that's multicultural American. That's what they said, this is our society. But again, surprisingly, they go back to their separate places. Not much integration. Surprisingly, a little intermarriage, except possibly between Puerto Ricans and blacks, but then a substantial number of Puerto Ricans are black. They meet often for political reasons, and not much more. What I call assimilative multiculturalism is the America which recognizes within this multicultural framework that there is an overarching culture, which used to be called the mainstream, which has become a bad word among the pluralistic group. One of the most savage criticisms I got from my recent book on the cultural matrix and black youth came from someone who blasted the work for as a crypto-assimilationist. This person, by the way, was a former graduate student of mine, so I can't imagine what other people and the kind of other terms they have for me, because I write about the mainstream. And the remarkable thing about this mainstream is that it is indeed the mainstream. It does draw from all the different cultures. It was doing this even during the period of slavery, in a sense. It is blackish. And one point I keep making to blacks is, you don't want to reject the American mainstream because it's black. Can't imagine American mainstream culture without black. Imagine America without blacks. Imagine America without music and so on. Essential. It's blackish and more than blackish. And its ultimate goal, of course, is the goal which Martin Luther King set for the civil rights movement, but which was abandoned later with the rise of pluralistic. Diversity. So, just to close off, since all of you are very interested in this, no doubt, the Trump victory seen in this light, it becomes very intriguing. You can begin to understand what actually went on. First of all, I want to emphasize again, the majority of voters in America voted for Hillary Clinton and her project. And it wasn't a small number. It's 2.7 million, and we're still counting. It may end up at 3 million. It's a huge, huge number of people, right? So her message did resonate substantially, and she won. Popular vote, unfortunately, she didn't win. This slave-made system, which we call, you know, okay, the Electoral College. Essentially, Trump's victory was based on number one, the revival, the intensification, the resurgence of the Herrenvorg part, neo-Confederate America. For a long time, they were quiet. They thought they had lost. They didn't vote. And the shock was, of course, number one, they came out and voted this time because they thought they finally found someone who spoke their language. They didn't vote as much for Romney. So this sort of example explains what happened in Florida. If the same proportion of whites who had voted in Florida voted in this election, Hillary Clinton would have won. And that's what we saw when we saw was happening. Not only liberals were expecting a landslide, and of course you heard about all the Latinos who are coming out and voting in great numbers before the day before. So Florida was seen as a landslide. What happened was the revival, intensification. Finally, we have a leader. This is when we saw the votes started coming in from the Florida panhandle, which is part of that belt, the neo-Confederate belt, which we saw, right? Finally, found a leader. So, as you know, Trump won big with sort of less educated white voters, but especially, the solid South he got. He didn't lose there. So the problem is his victory depended, and nobody thought he would do this, on winning Florida, of course, which came from the intensified, revitalized sort of racial vote. But he could not have won only for those racial reasons, okay? He won because he carried middle America. Okay, that group, in geographic terms, the Midlands, in more specific state terms, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, okay, Indiana. And Ohio, which voted twice for Obama. And the reason that group voted against him is that it goes back to Larry Bobo's, if you like, laissez-faire racism. That is, and I wouldn't call it racism. The appeal there was, of course, the deindustrialization of America and globalization. They were the groups who really hard hit, and they felt that no one was talking to them. Now, the fact that they felt no one was talking to them. Every interview which has been done later indicates that many of the people who voted for Trump had voted for Obama and had voted for him for the same reasons. They thought he was a change agent, and they thought Trump was going to. They're catching hell, and nobody's listening to them. And one of explanation, and it's still controversial, I'm still thinking about it, is that one reason why Middle America felt that it wasn't being listened to was because of the overemphasis on multiculturalism by Clinton. Is that racism? Your guess is as good as mine here. I don't want to make any. So it's the fact that they were a very, very sort of a group which is really catching hell, whose income has now stagnated, and in fact, in the last 15, 20 years, and in fact, it's getting worse for many of them. High incidence of social this organization, growing incidence of suicide, the life expectancy rates of men in this group has gone down. This is unbelievable in the richest country in the world. Huge rise in the opiate use, the sort of epidemic of opiate overdose in this area. The young sees little hope, no jobs, and especially for the less educated, really, McDonald's jobs. These are people who are expecting good middle class lives. In the factories, you could change your cars every 5 years, you could have a nice home in the suburbs, you could send your kids to college, you could expect that your kids are going to do as well as you or even better. Gone, gone, gone. And they felt that Obama was talking to them with his message of change. That's why they rejected Romney. So Romney was a capitalist, and so on. And Obama was able to use that very effectively. And of course, he's just a better speaker, so he appealed to that group. Hillary didn't make it with that group. There was emphasis now, people claim, overemphasis on the multicultural thing. Where were we in that dialogue? Where were we in that narrative? So, a combination then of deep despair about their economic situation and the fact that they felt neglected is the major factor, not race. Well, maybe in a little bit of it, but the fact that people who voted twice for Obama, they can't vote twice for a black president and say they're a racist politically. And people resent it when they're told that it's racial. It may be of the covert, there may be a little covertness involved in it and so, but this is not a Herringbrook thing where a black presidency is one of the factors that really led to the revival, starting with the Tea Party. These guys were really, really motivated and instigated. They were quiet for a long time because they felt they had lost out. Now, you know, I mean, a black president, give us our country back. We want our country back. The fact that they denied Obama his birthright, starting with Trump. So his appeal to them was sort of sunken as denying the birther movement was the core. But I remember the central feature of slavery and the neo-Confederate thing, that blacks did not belong. What more powerful symbolic statement can you make about a black president than that he wasn't born here? That as in he's an imposter. All blacks are imposters. They don't belong here. So that immediately nailed it for him with that group and also revived them, if you like. Okay? So there's no doubt about the strength. But he was going to win that section anyway, most of that area. Well, not entirely. I mean, that explains his victory, say, not so much in Texas, which he was going to win, but in the states such as Florida and in North Carolina. They were coming out from the woods, when the woods works. I mean, you know, their voters, who hadn't voted all their lives, were suddenly coming out. Taylor is expected to win North Carolina. In fact, North Carolina voted for a Democratic president, governor. They were suddenly, no one knew where they're coming from. These were the groups who were the silent minority of the Herringbrook types who came out and ensured his victory in these critical states, Florida, North Carolina, almost won in Virginia. Again, the same thing, they're coming from the rural areas and so on. Wisconsin, again, Pennsylvania, which had voted Democratic for the last, since the 80s, down that belt, the coal mining areas of Ohio and so on, they just came out in vast numbers. Many of them would never voted in their lives before. And that's how we won. So that's the story of where America is right now. Complex. Can't just go around and say America's gone racist. It's just much more complicated than that. America is far better off, and I'd rather live in America than anywhere else, France or England or anywhere else, in light of what I just said. I live in one of the bluest states. I've been told that New York is even bluer than Massachusetts, but you know.
New York.
Yeah, but You got to see the great progress has been made, what has not been achieved, and the fluke of Trump winning, both the slave originating college, electoral college, combined with the revitalizing of the Herrenvoch vote, and the appeal to the largely neglected Rust Belt group who felt left behind by industrialization, globalization, and who felt, and in this respect, race was indirectly important, who felt that the overemphasis on multiculturalism was simply another way of neglecting them. And that's where we're at right now, friends. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor Patterson. Very illuminating talk that takes us beyond the caricature of this very complex country that we have. I heard a version of this talk exactly December 8th at NYU when I invited you there. Of course, this is way, way more complex than the one you gave at NYU, but I was nonetheless very impressed because it did influence our definition of the project that Nicole and myself had. When you said there was nothing surprising about Obama becoming the president of America, because if you take the top 100 American companies, they had a lot of black presidents already. So that this integration from the top down was really impressive to me. And I thought about it a lot. And because I'm coming from the background in the US of, you know, the civil rights movement, you know, from the Black Panthers, Black Power, Afrocentrists, and so on, and who actually are still not buying this kind of argument. That is, they still blame America, whereas if one listened to your brilliant presentation, we actually, black middle class actually should ask itself a question, in a sense that, how come I teach at NYU, you teach at Harvard? How come black people have not advanced, and yet people like myself, yourself, are fairly well accepted in America, you know? So you brought up that question, and I think that's a very deep question, and it points to the responsibility. This does not, it's not an exculpation of white America and racism, because you clearly define that, but it is, for once, asking the question, what happened in black middle class in relation to the black working class? And I think that's quite important. The other aspect that I'm still trying to understand, because your talk was sociological, historical, and cultural, and I'm only in the cultural side of your talk, the Electoral College, its inception, I've heard Angela Davis talk about this also. I'm still trying to understand it, because in Africa, in many ways, where I'm from originally, if you have the chiefs voting for you, you win the presidential election. So I'm trying to connect it to this, either the African chiefdoms, because when Kwame Nkrumah came to power in Ghana, he wanted to abolish the chiefdom. When Modibo Keita came to Mali as president, he too, because of the republic, the French system of republic, wanted to get rid of the chiefs. Now, are the whites the chiefs of the American South? I'm still trying to understand this. But so if those two questions, the black middle class on the one hand, and then if you can say a little more about the Electoral College, and we didn't do a proper introduction of Professor Patterson, but he's won all the major awards in terms of academic writing in the United States, and was an editorialist for the New York Times for years, wrote novels. It's really, I wrote an essay one time on C.L.R. James's Beyond a Boundary, and he wrote a lot on cricket, and of course, that was a big inspiration. Later on, they asked me to come and comment on cricket. I don't know the cricket rules. I'm more soccer than, football than cricket. So this is a monumental man sitting here, and we're very happy to have you at NYU. Yes.
Thank you very much. They're very kind of you. Very appreciate that, what you said, very much. On the black middle class, well, the first thing to note is that it was an unusual one, which achieved success due to many special efforts made by the power elite to improve their condition as part of this, if you like, top-down situation. One of the most important was affirmative action. Okay? Affirmative action in many areas, but mainly in middle-class areas, universities, schools, and but also in jobs and so on. And in a way, they got a very strong push from this. And a lot of the people who, in fact, ended up making it within this middle class group were people who were unusually talented and motivated, but who in many ways perhaps did not have the conventional, if you like, qualification or means of entering the middle class position. They were highly motivated, they were very bright people, but came through with the strong help of white leadership, liberal white leadership. Now, one thing's here of Bourdieu, because as Bourdieu has taught us, the French sociologist, you all know and have read Bourdieu, I take it. Maintaining middle class status involves more than just going to school. In fact, what the middle class kids bring to school is as important, if not more important, than what they learn in school. He calls this cultural capital. That's the Bourdieusian term. And one of the simple explanations, just one, I can give, is that in Bourdieusian terms, in a sense, you had a middle class which had made it with great help and with great motivation and great struggle, who perhaps did not have all the social cultural capital yet. It's an unusual one to pass on to their children. It's only part of the explanation. So you had then a higher than usual failure rate among their children in the school system because of the unconventional way they had developed. They didn't have that cultural capital to sort of do what middle class people normally do, which is to ensure the reproduction of their class. And that's happening with a vengeance now, by the way, among the American elite. There's a rise of inequality, but several studies have shown now that associative marriage and sort of the use of wealth to ensure that their kids get in the best schools and so on is guaranteeing that American inequality, which is one of the worst in the world, is solidifying. As, you see, it's not that the schools are being prejudiced or any in their selection, but the point is that, and this doesn't, I'm going beyond race now, I'm saying this is true of all whites and so on, that
the elite schools are getting the kids of the elite, because the elites have an enormous amount of both physical and cultural capital to pass on to their kids. We just guarantee that they get into Harvard, even though Harvard is being completely, quote unquote, fair in its selection process. The elite is consolidating. And I know that I've sat on the, Harvard is one of the most prestigious universities. I've been on the admissions committee, and I see how it works. They try their damnedest to sort of get a diversified sort of group, but you can't when you're getting kids who are, you know, doing all sorts of incredible things. They've gone to Africa by the age of 16 to do good. They've won every trophy you can imagine. Their parents are paying $40,000 per tutor to ensure that they write the right essays and so on. You can't win against that, okay? So the first answer is that they lack the cultural capital for reproduction, given the unusual nature. And then when you have that hostility to further affirmative action, means that the youth were not having those advantages, okay? The second explanation is more controversial, and that's when people start calling me a conservative. So centuries of oppression of a people create both external constraints, both direct constraints of racism and all the form of discrimination and so on. But even when these are withdrawn, the institutionalized form of racism is persistent and so on. So that exists. It's one set of restraints. But centuries of oppression also do things to people. Messes them up in many ways. Now you can say that in Europe, one of the most eminent British sociologists, Willis, okay, in his book Learning to Labor, can write about how working class British lads, as he called them, end up guaranteeing that they end up as workers because of the cultural patterns that they have of masculinity and so on, their attitude towards work, their attitude towards women, their attitude towards learning, that's not manly and so on. So read Willis's book, Learning to Labor. Now, no one called Willis a racist. He's in fact a Marxist. But when I say the same sort of thing about black Americans, I immediately get kicked out of the house, as a conservative. Because what I'm saying is that centuries of oppression in terms of people's adaptations, in the same way that centuries of working class oppression lead to the lads, as Willis calls them, sort of, behaving and having attitudes and which lead to them, in fact, becoming workers and perpetuating the system. There were problems. Problems of slavery created internally of distrust, gender distrust between black men and women, familial fragility, which my structuralist friends would like to attribute only to recent structural factors, which doesn't make any sense, because we know it goes back very far, leading to a situation in which 73% of black kids are now being born to single mothers now, who have themselves real economic problems. I've got to add that, because a single mother is quite capable of bringing up a kid quite well if she has the resources. But to be in an environment, being brought up by a single mother without resources who's working two McDonald's jobs to survive, puts you at a great disadvantage. And as Sarah McLachlan and any number of sociologists have shown, guarantees downward mobility. So that's the problem. There are a set of internal problems, and then segregation, the third factor, which is a major factor, which is neglected. Now, the reason why segregation is neglected as a major factor for so long, people are beginning to take it seriously. You'd have thought this is a huge issue. And Martin Luther King thought it was a huge issue, and segregation and desegregation was one of his major pillars of his effort. But people shifted from this as a major factor. There are complex reasons why black leadership dropped the issue. One of them has to do with the rise of multiculturalism. Black pride and the fact that we don't need you to be living with you to solve, you know, we promote ourselves. We believe in our own community. Black politicians are also ambivalent about talk of desegregation because their base lies in the ghettos. So segregation got knocked off the table of major issues to be confronted. In fact, it is the single, in my view, most important factor explaining black problems. The whole point of segregation was not only to dishonor blacks, you don't want to live with them, but also to exclude them from the cultural capital, as Bourdieu would call it. That didn't guarantee success. And now, finally, people are taking segregation seriously again, thanks in part to the French-American sociologist Loïc Wacquant, who's done wonderful work on urban outcasts and others, showing that segregation matters. Finally, the economists have come around. The economists, for a long time, sort of reinforced the view that segregation didn't matter because they, in their very rationalistic view, took the view that it's all selection. A series of major studies were done in the 90s called the Movement to Opportunity Studies, which was an experimental study of five major cities, in which they did an experimentally look at people who moved out of the ghettos and were encouraged to move with vouchers, but also weren't just thrown out into middle class areas, but helped in their adjustment. And an experimental group which was given vouchers, but did what most blacks in the ghetto do, which is to find other houses in the ghettos. And they observed them very carefully. At first, they claimed they didn't find many results, which struck me as ridiculous. One reason being it's just too early to find results. So 15 years later, a group of bright young economists went back and observed the data and found enormous results. Differences between those who had left the ghettos and those who the control group who use the vouchers to remain in the ghettos. Big differences in income, in educational levels, in where they lived, and their social interaction with whites. Segregation matters. And as Mary Petula shows in her now almost classic work, Black Picket Fences, read that book. The blacks who left the inner cities, the middle class blacks, did not go very far away. Number one, they were just as segregated. Number two, they were not very far away from the inner cities. And in fact, she showed that they shared a lot of institutions and that their kids were strongly influenced by what you call the ghetto, more street culture. Dig downward mobility. Okay, so these are some of the factors which explain. I could go into far more detail, right? But it gets controversial. When I say racism, institutional racism persisted and so on, yeah, everybody say, yeah. When I mention all the structural factors, when I start talking about the internal factors, people said, well, you're conservative. Your second question was, what is the second?
The Electoral College.
The Electoral College is complicated because it goes, well, as I try to explain, the people who founded wrote the Constitution, and it was just a huge bargaining to the state, all the states were going to join, and the conditions which they laid down. And for the South, the two big factors, and they were closely related, was number one, as I said, that they did not want to be dominated by the more populous North. So they decided on a more chieftainship system. That is to say, they said the people can't be trusted to vote. The original plan, in fact, was that the electors, would indeed, in the, whatever they choose, they could go against the will of the people if they wanted to. And they still can, in theory, do. And they got support in the North and that, because people like Hamilton, who's being celebrated now, was very much, an elitist in that regard. So, but the South did not want a popular simple party. They wanted this electoral college. And when they got it, of course, part of their negotiation then was that we would count the slaves as part of the population, which then increased their numbers significantly, even though the slaves weren't voting. So we ended up with electoral college partly because of the fact that even though this is supposed to be the start of this great democracy, there's real suspicion of the people. But the slave South, in its bargaining, wanted to make sure that, number one, it had enough people to increase the number of its electoral voters, but that the blacks wouldn't vote. So there was really elaborate negotiations in this regard, and they won. And so we ended up with this peculiar system. It was the South in particular which held out for the electoral college system, right? And with the aid of a few Northerners like Hamilton, but most people saw that it was primarily a means for the smaller state to sort of have some balance. And that's why, by the way, people every time, this is the fourth time it's happened in America in which the candidate with the minority vote wins. The last time was only not so long ago, 16 years ago. That was happened with Al Gore. There's always talk about changing the system, but it will never change because you need a constitutional change to change it. And the only way you're going to have a constitutional change by having, I think, 2/3 of the states vote and none of the the smaller states. You have places like Wyoming, which does hardly have 1 million people. And they're not going to change because it gives a great advantage to the smaller states. So that's, it was a kind of chieftainship system. It didn't come from Africa. It came, however, from the slave South, who did have a strong view of idea of freedom as power and domination and control.